Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. With a Master's in International Development, a Bachelor of Social Work and a Bachelor of Social Science majoring in Psychology, Louise is an Inclusion Engagement Specialist with a background in Facilitation, Training and Youth Community Development. Today we chat around empowered youth work and what meaningful, inclusive engagement with young people looks like. Louise shares 5 tips around truly engaging and working with young people with honesty and sincerity. Welcome, Louise. Louise Grant, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your story journey with our listeners. Really excited to have you here talking to me and also at the conference. So thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Where do we want to start? Let's start with your journey. So to give our listeners a bit of context to who you are and where you're at today, where did your journey start?
Hi, I'm Louise. I use she, her pronouns and I'm 32. And I think it's really important that we all share our ages.
Well, there you go.
I think we should share our ages because if we're working with young people, we often ask them what their age is.
I like that. I'm 40.
Thanks for sharing. So yeah, I started my journey. I guess I did I wanted to help people. I guess that's where it started. And I did a social work and a psychology degree. Didn't feel like I learned enough.
Whereabouts?
At RMIT.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What was the social work? What was the course like?
Good. I think RMIT does it well, or I enjoyed it a lot to the classes I did go to.
Right. I understand that.
I think I was quite young and naive when I started. And what's an interesting thing is that my partner, he is currently doing the same course and has just started. And his journey to that was he went and did plumbing. He stopped.
Wow.
Stopped high school, went and did plumbing, worked in plumbing and those big high rises.
Yeah.
Wanted to change. And he got into the same course I did. So I study hard. I got a really high, ATAR and worked really hard to get that. And he also, you know, worked hard in his life and got there in a different journey. So
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, there's multiple ways to do the things that you love.
So he'll just take all your work and your answers and resubmit them?
He does that. He just puts it through GPT.
GPT. It writes it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, how good is that?
No, he does hard work.
Well, that's great. So is that on the back of your experience that he's been inspired to take that up?
Yeah, I certainly encouraged him to, he wanted to be someone who also helped people and take people on a journey in a different way. I like to focus on big picture things and how we change systems and society, and he likes to look at the individual. So you can do the same course, you can do social work and end up helping people in very, very different ways. So he's going that way, and I said, I think you should do social work. You just get a really broad perspective on what's happening in the world and take that complex system and distill it down to that one person. And can see whole ways of influences on that one person, and instead of just taking a very flat side or what they might be telling you, you can have a broader perspective.
What really got you into wanting to do social work in the first place?
I was 18. I really didn't know what I wanted.
Okay. So it was just something that was proximity. So it was just something that was there and you thought.
Yeah. I knew someone who wasn't even a social worker, and I want to be a social worker. My mum said, you should probably do psych as well and get a broader perspective too. And that's what I did. And I ended up doing my second placement overseas as well.
Whereabouts?
Sweden.
Wow.
So I ended up.
What an experience.
I just went and said, F it, I'll just go over there and do what I can. And yeah, I ended up working in a jail there on an island. And it was a very.
What?
Yeah.
In Sweden, on an island, in a jail.
Yeah, working with young men. There was no fences. There was just, and their system is so set up differently. It's set up to really, to acknowledge that maybe the system has failed them and we need to take care of these young men and we need to do the work to get them on the path to get better or to have a better situation in their life. Very much of a wraparound system that I don't see as much here, but I don't work in the justice system here, so I don't have that perspective. But it was a very interesting way to get a perspective.
No fences because it was an island?
Yeah, I think that the staff were very blasé. Yeah, basically because there was no island, but they didn't, because it was on an island. I just don't think they really needed to. And there wasn't that many young men. I think there were maybe 30. And my favourite part was that every day, all of the staff and all of the young men would come together and eat lunch together that was put on by this most amazing chef who decided that he didn't really want to chef in big restaurants. He wanted to chef in places where people had never had that kind of food before.
Wow.
So you'd have these massive banquets with beautiful food and it really became quite aspirational for a lot of the young men there.
So let's talk about that for a second. I mean, are we seeing, is that whole system of incarceration a lot more successful as far as?
Look, it's not my expertise. That was my experience. And I was there for 6 months and
it's very different.
It is very different. And I think what that taught me was that when we treat our young people with dignity, when we really slow things down, give them ample opportunity, not just one opportunity, you have to pass this that now, otherwise you'll never get it. If you don't do year 12 now, you will never succeed. That's what a lot of young people here feel these days. And I didn't get that experience when I was in Sweden 10 years ago now, but yeah. And it certainly set me on a journey of looking at other things. I did my Masters of International Development after that, which is basically international social work. And from that, we learned more about these power dynamics and learned more about what it looks like when a powerful institution really looks after their young people. Yeah.
Is that looking at social work internationally and seeing the differences and seeing what works, what doesn't work? Is that what that is around, or are you talking more around what are you talking around?
So there's, I really got to explore that more in my master's. So I saw that a little bit in the second placement in Sweden. But what we can see in many organizations, let's look at the NGO, international NGOs here. So what we might be looking at is, they're going to go into a country, they're going to go to a community, and they're going to deliver some sort of service.
Yep.
Now, if you look at that just from the outside, you're seeing an organization most likely that has a lot of money or is backed by governments or people and they're trying to get money from people with money.
Yep.
And then they're going to go to most likely a country that doesn't have
systems in place. Resources.
Yep. And so, and the community receiving that will see, oh my goodness, there's this big organization coming with all this money, coming to our community to do something. In that process, you may have, I don't know how to describe this, but you may have people not able to have their voices heard because you want to put only your best people forward, or you only want to have, I think there was a story I learned about when an organization went to a country, and I can't remember which country it was, but I think this illustrates the point. They went to go and scope what the community needed. And they sat at the front of this community meeting, all the men sitting down in front of them, then all the women at the back standing, and then no children in the room at all. So when we talk about an organization coming from a powerful place, a place of power, just symbolically you can see whose voices in that room are going to be heard first. It's going to be the men, and then it's going to be the women maybe, and it's not going to be the children at all. So you see that a lot in international development. And you see that in our own home here, who's here, who's not here. And those concepts are really talked about a lot in international development, and I think quite a bit in social work these days too.
Yeah, I mean, what an interesting thing. I mean, power dynamics of large organizations and the impact that has of framing the way things are done.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an academic, a paper written. His last name's Lukes. Can't remember who it is, but anyway. The concept is that there's three levels of power. Level one is overt. There's one version and it's overt. You can see people arguing. So you and I might have an argument. From the outside, we can see I'm arguing, you're arguing, and it's all about the points that are being argued. the second kind of another level of power is who set the agenda. So who put that argument on the plate, on the paper in front of us, and who didn't? And who's not being on the agenda? So I have a meeting with my executives and I'm going to bring some young people in to talk about some issues. And this young person wants to talk about an issue I don't really agree with. And so I'm going to put 5 minutes on for that to talk about that on the agenda. And I'm going to put 20 minutes to talk about the thing I want them to talk about.
Right.
Right. So the power, you don't notice that power is imbalance is kind of there. And then the third, agenda setting is what that's called. And then the third level of power is symbolic. So what are you wearing that shows that you're a powerful person in the room? What are you saying? What are the kind of words that you might be saying that shows that you know something or you don't know something? So.
Yep. Stephen Luke's.
Thank you.
Three dimensions of power.
Really great article.
So that's, I mean, some of that stuff is subtle, isn't it? Like,
for sure.
Subconscious even.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to go and present later on this afternoon. Am I going to wear a big bold red lip? What might that say to someone? Will they trust me more? I'm going to wear, or I am currently wearing, these big rainbow earrings. Hopefully that, you know, maybe sends a message without someone even talking to me that maybe I'm a safe person for someone in the LGBTI community. So maybe I'm going to, if I'm very tall, maybe I'm going to, you know, wear big, powerful things to make myself feel really big. So yeah, they're symbols of power.
And the impact that can have on, so in organizational settings around agendas and stuff like this, we're saying that people are intentionally doing.
It can be subconscious.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if I don't want my boss to know how badly I'm doing at a job, I'm not going to put that on the agenda.
Yes. Yeah.
But it can also be said, like, well, how much is an organization in their policies prioritizing this issue over the other issue? Who are they? What issues are they choosing? That's the agenda setting. And you can see it like in the government, like, let's look at question time. What questions are allowed to be asked and what questions aren't? Which ones are dixes and which ones aren't?
Yeah, yeah.
That will set the, because if you're not allowed to talk, then the issue doesn't even come up.
No, it is interesting, isn't it? So that's, so you did your international social work.
International development.
International development, which was focusing on that.
Yep.
Then what happened? Where do you go?
Yeah, so I took, what's funny is that my social work and psychology degrees, that took 5 years. And then my international development, that should have only taken 1 year if I did it full time. I think it took me 5 years as well.
Right.
I did it so part time. Because I really just wanted to take it slow and integrate all the things I was learning really deeply in my work. I worked at a youth organization called Oak Tree for a little while. It was part volunteer, part paid, and it was full time. I got broke from it, but I loved it. And it set something up in my brain about youth-led work and really empowered youth-led work. It gives you opportunity to just experiment. Jump into the thick of things. You've never led a group of young people? Well, here's four. You've never run a campaign before? Well, here's a $1 million campaign. Off you go. Run with it. Do the best you can. And we'll support you to do it. That is so empowering. Incredible opportunity. I think I stuffed up so many times. But it set this nugget in my head that was like, yeah, young people know how to do this if you give them opportunity. Yeah.
So empowering young people rather than talking to them or at them.
Absolutely. And it was by young people. At Oak Tree, no one's allowed to be over 26.
Wow.
Yeah. You have to. So, and they were doing, you know, and there is a legacy of what the work that they did. And I really do value every opportunity I got through that organization. And there are always going to be critics of the work that they might do, but it was invaluable in my journey. And then after that, I went to the Department of Health and Human Services and worked in some disability. I'd done some disability work before. Oh, yeah. I did a whole year of disability work. That was fun.
There you go.
Worked in the trenches.
Yeah. Good on you.
Yeah.
And how was that experience?
Oh, it was incredibly humbling. Yeah. So there was a year I was supposed to finish my social work and psych degree. My brother didn't hand something in for me and it delayed my graduation by a year. I was in New Zealand.
Oh, sabotaging.
And so I couldn't work in New Zealand. Because I, like, in any sort of profession, I had done 5 years of uni work, two placements. I had no degrees to speak of it. So I started doing disability work, which is really hands-on disability work in homes. incredibly humbling. I wiped bottoms and changed people. And I remember crying to my grandmother, who was a nurse, and being like, I don't like this. This is what I was. I had such an entitlement to, I deserve better. I've done all this study. I deserve better. And which is incredibly dismissive, I think. It's not a great attitude to have. But I learned an amazing, humbling experience of you hold so much power in caring for people who are not able to do it themselves, who are incredibly strong and resilient people. And you can see that resilience. They don't have to. The people that I was working with often weren't verbal, but they had a voice. They had a voice, and it was your responsibility to ensure that voice was respected and upheld and had dignity. So, yeah, I learned a very humbling experience, and I thank the people I worked with for teaching me how to slow down and how to connect with people in different ways and to stop being so entitled.
Yeah, but what a great experience.
Yeah.
And it changed a few of your belief systems and yeah, probably the way you looked at things.
Yeah, for sure. And also a deep, deep understanding about what it is to be in the disability system, to be interacting with funding bodies and not on the government end, on the service end.
Right.
In your home, what does it actually mean to get $50 a week for, physiotherapy? What does it mean to someone when they get that? How life-changing it is for them, maybe. And so when you have that perspective, yeah, if I had to make a recommendation, best thing I ever did in my life was to do the hardest thing I did was to do that disability support work but it was my experience that I had come from such an entitled thinking, I think, that yep, to be working with that the people I worked with gave me such an amazing perspective that yep, I still carry with me today, that yep, a sense of how do we create a world with dignity for everyone?
That's beautifully said.
Thank you.
So that was very, very well put. So okay, so from there, NDIS stuff.
I did a little bit of that.
Yeah, so.
More on the side of, so that made me, right, yeah, I experienced a year of working in DHHS when the NDIS was switching from going from state to the mm-hmm, NDIS state, supports to NDIS. I worked on it's just a myriad of things, but I was basically approving supports and funding for people with disability. And wow, because I had worked in New Zealand and saw what that support looked like, I could say, actually, that's not enough, or mm-hmm, that is enough, and I can tick it off.
Yeah.
I remember one time, and I don't drink coffee because of this, I had drunk a coffee, got my anxiety up, got my nerves up, and then I found out that an organization just hadn't supported a person. I don't think they supported them very well at all. I was very outraged with the support plan that they had submitted and just went on a tirade with my manager and was like, this is not good enough. How dare they, this organization support this person so inappropriately, and, they don't even care. They don't even care about this person. They're not even submitting anything properly. And I called the person themselves, and then I called their family to make sure that they had the supports in. And then I went upstairs to the people who work with that organization and was like, you need to make sure.
Wowza.
I went on, my manager sent me home. I came back the next day. I was like, okay, I'm feeling better, but that shouldn't have happened.
No more coffee for you.
No more coffee.
So okay, hide
but
the coffee.
I was so outraged. Yeah, no, I was so outraged because I knew what the supports should look like after working on the ground.
Yep.
And that when an organization doesn't support their client well.
Yeah, it's real. The impact is real.
The impact is real. And it was, I felt really great that I was in a position of power because I was in the government who was giving out money or approving people for money. And I could say, actually, that's not good enough. Get better. That's cool.
That is cool. Such real change.
Yeah, I hope so.
And so from there?
I went to the Office for Youth at the Victorian government and finished my master's when I was there. And that's when I started really working. I'd worked in youth, I'd done a whole lot of youth stuff, but that's when I really started working in youth advisory groups. And that's where I now kind of really focus my work. Sorry, this has been a very long story about how I've been here.
That's okay. Time's up. No, I'm just joking. I think it's been really interesting because you can see how one thing led to another and the experiences are built upon each other and led you to what you're doing now, which is some really amazing things.
Yeah.
And let's talk about what you're doing now and how that supports inclusion of young voices.
Yeah, so I started getting really passionate about youth voice. I mean, I always was, but that started to be my main focus. I got an opportunity to set, kind of run the what is called the Victorian Youth Congress. It's called the it's a youth advisory group to the Victorian government and the office of the Minister for Youth. And I did many a few years of that and kind of iterated it. And from that, I wanted to do that in state government, got an amazing experience there, wanted to see that on the ground as well. So now I do that at Yarra Rangers Council, actually. And then in my own space, in my own time, I focus on how do we do inclusive youth engagement and consultation with young people. And what we mean by that, like what I mean by that is, how do you think about true, meaningful, engaged consultation, true, meaningful and diverse inclusive engagement that is meaningful for everyone. Yeah.
So we're not box ticking.
No, absolutely not.
So we want to know how to do this in a way that actually is creating, is set up from the first part, set up properly,
yeah,
and provided a real platform for the absolutely real voices to be able to come through.
And having multiple ways of doing that. There's not one way of doing it. But if you're going to do a tick box type exercise, which is fine, you know, not a tick box. Let's say you want to do a survey. It's probably the most, you know, literally has tick boxes in it. Then there are ways that you can make accessible to young people. So, yeah, that's my focus. My focus is on, and then a lot of it is about, yeah, what happens when an adult comes into a youth space? What happens when we're asking young people's opinions? We're often asking young people to come into an adult space.
So let's see, what are some of these examples where we're seeing this happen, because I assume it's happening, it's everywhere. Getting more and more popular.
Yeah, everywhere. So I'll make an example of where I currently work at Yarra Rangers Council. We have a council, they make decisions on many things. So I don't know, they might be making a decision about the way Lilydale, which is a suburb in Melbourne, the way Lilydale's looking and some of the murals that they want to put up and how should it feel and what should it look like, because we've, you know, going to revitalize Lilydale. We've got urban planners. We've got people who don't work with young people as part of their profession, architects. And we need to have a youth voice in that. We need to know how young people are going to use that space in order to make sure it's accessible and user friendly. And we need to know how they're using the space currently and what their vision is for the future. So,
It gives them a voice at the table to be able to have influence.
Yep.
On the way it's designed.
Absolutely. So in order to do that, now we could just go, okay, we're going to get youth voice, let's go get five young people, bring them in, ask them. That's great.
Five different ages, boy, girl, boy, just mix
gender,
the genders,
non-binary, everything.
Yep.
But are you actually looking at intersectionality? Are you looking at how someone who has disability, or, and that could be, you know, a non-visible disability, how does someone from the LGBTIQA+ community interact with that space, feel safe, not safe? How does someone, Lilydale's an interesting one because it's kind of a bit of, it's called the end of the line,
right,
as in it's the start, the end of the line, like it's the closest to the city for a lot of those young people in that region.
Okay.
Whereas if you don't know, Lilydale feels, if you're in the city, at the end of the line. Like,
right. It's like the border.
It's at the end of the train line at least.
Oh, okay. That's where it stops.
Yeah.
Literally. Okay. So
for a lot of young people, they may be coming into Lilydale and accessing that in different ways. So yeah, you not only need a diverse voice in there, but in order to get those young people in the room to give you that advice, there's something interesting that happens. So young people, like, they're very, very interested in the issues around them and they're often discussing what's happening, but they're often not discussing those things in places where adults are. You'll find young people are talking about the issues, you know, maybe in their Instagram stories, and maybe it's happening. There's so much happening.
Really?
Yeah. 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 Like, I remember a young person being like, oh, this is what's happening in a town, Warburton, and there's this, you know, factory estate and they're doing all this stuff there. And the councillors or and the adults in the room were like, oh my goodness, we didn't know that at all. And all the young people were like, yeah, we all know this. We talk about it in the yard or on our socials, or we know about it, but those places are not youth friendly.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Those places are not adult. The adults aren't there. So when an adult steps into the room, you've got a group of young people, and when an adult steps into the room, young people are like hyper aware of the power imbalance. You may know things that they don't know. You're dressed in a certain way. you know, you have 10, 20 years experience on them, and it can feel very intimidating. And it can also cause feelings of abrasiveness and apprehension. So before anyone's spoken, and that's that power dynamic I talked about before, that symbolic power. So, and it's often, yeah, so there, it's often assumed by young people that ultimately they won't be listened to by adults. So I've got a quote here, and I really want to say it. So this is a quote from a young person I worked with who was reflecting on that. It says this: I was selected to be on the youth advisory group because I was passionate about issues and wanted to see a change in the world. I worked hard to understand other people's perspectives and bring that into a place where adults were making big decisions in our community. And yet, on multiple occasions when we spoke to the adults, we heard the phrase, "I didn't expect you to be talking about these issues." And I always felt frustrated when I heard that. I had worked hard to prepare for a consultation, but the adults were only interested or impressed by my ability to be interested in an issue. It felt like they had never had a high expectations from me in the first place. To me, it sounded like the only thing the adult took away from the consultation with me was the idea that this young person wasn't a child.
Wow.
And it's just, young people are assessing, they're already apprehensive. They're already saying, you're probably not going to listen to me. And many people have been taught they should be seen, not heard, and have experienced, you know, vilification, homophobia, xenophobia, misogyny. And so when they see an adult walk into the space, there is a power dynamic already because you're older. Because you work in this organization, you have power to change things. And they're wondering, can I talk about my friends here? Can I talk about my pronouns, my experiences, my mob? And so when we talk about safe spaces for young people to be able to express their views, we're talking about, making those safe spaces.
It's almost like, what's the point of asking in the first place if you weren't really going to listen to what they were going to say?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's for a lot of young people, maybe over and over again, before they've even come into the room with you to consult, they may have heard it from their teachers or from their parents or from their, you know, adults around them in their life that, their emotions have been dismissed or their ideas have been dismissed. And so you're just another adult. Until they trust you, you're just another adult who's not going to listen to my ideas. And so when you're working in youth advisory groups, it's often like you're just working to break down that there are trusted adults out there who want to hear from you.
So what's some tips or advice for people or organizations that are engaging with youth? How do they maximize the involvement, the participation of youth being at the table, in part of the group? How do we get that engagement? How do we make it feel like it's a safe space? And I assume a lot would have to do with how you lay the ground, the foundation from the start. Because if you don't lay that safe space and create that, then no matter what happens after that, they won't feel safe.
Well, they won't come either.
But you tell me the tips.
Yeah. Okay. So these tips I think I've come up with. Well, I haven't actually come up with them. So these tips, let's start that again. So I worked with some young people and they've got some tips, I think, they're trying to share with a lot of adults. And I wish that I could bring them along here and you could hear it from their voice, but it's me you've got. So firstly, I think if you authentically listen to young people, it is a healing experience. It can be a healing experience and it can be a ripple effect to their, you know, to their networks. So tip one, prioritize, this is for your whole team, prioritize youth issues. So like you can recognize that there are many issues in our society that are going to affect young people, even if it's not immediately visible to you. So you want to prioritize youth issues, even if you're deciding how government's bins are going to look like or how your waiting room is going to look like. You can prioritize young people, prioritize their issues. Number two, seek out youth voices. So find them where they are, find young people where they are, rather than ask them to come to you.
Right.
So if you're going to do a consultation at a train station, probably do it at after school times, you know, not at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Recognize that young people are diverse, I guess, in that way too. That's how you seek out youth voices and consider, you know, that intersectionality. Partnering with a youth organization, some youthy people. And I think that's the other part of that is number three, I would say, make yourself accessible. So that's when we're talking about that symbolic power dynamic. Wear something that identifies you as a safe person. We heard from a young person said today at the conference, don't try too hard. Don't try to be youthy if you're not youthy. Just be yourself.
There you go.
Yeah, I think what I tend to do when I get an adult from any other, you know, any other place that's not in the youth team to come and consult with young people, I ask them to reveal a part of themselves. Be vulnerable. Hey, I have a this dog. I do this. I came from this background. You know, open up a little bit about yourself, because how can someone trust you if you're not revealing any part of you?
Yeah.
And then be a safe adult. So when you're consulting with young people, you're often asking for their, you might be talking about big issues, mental health. Educate yourself a little bit about what makes a safe space, what makes a safe adult, and get advice from a youth practitioner about how to present information if you're not really across it. And then young people were saying that they need to, like the quote I said before, challenge your own assumptions, actively listen to young people, ask questions. And then the tip five, and it's really, really important, how are you going to feed back to young people how their voice is going to be used in the work? You have to feed back. You have to put that into your project planning. Let young people know how their input will be used. Ask them, if I can I use this, what you've said? I want to use it in this way. And then come back in a month, 6 months, and say, hey, this is how we did it. Mm-hmm. Young people just, it's the most important thing.
This is what we did as a result of your consultation. This is what's been done.
Yeah. This is what we're doing here. Mm. So those five tips, they were created by young people. Hopefully I haven't filtered out too many things. It's so important that we should have youth voice here, but you got me.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get it. No, that's okay. You're doing a good job on it. So I think it's very important, because we're starting to see this being adopted, the, you know, getting involvement, getting voices to the table in many things,
yes,
with, especially with their mental health. We're starting to see lived experience. We're starting to see cultural voices coming in, which is good, designing, co-designing. So where do you see the future of this? And if you could wave your wand for the future, like what does Oz look like to you with all of this? What's the destination look like, where you look at it and go, oh, this is,
yeah, so
this is awesome.
It's hard. With cost of living, by the way, it's COSI. Cost of living, COSI.
COSI, cost of.
I don't know, COSI.
COSI, okay.
So with COSI, with cost of living crisis, all organisations will have less money. It's stretched.
Yes.
Things cost more. Now, if you have less funding, you may then make some cuts to some accommodations. Maybe you can't afford taxis anymore. Maybe you can't afford Auslan interpreters anymore. I worry that youth voice may not be prioritized so much, or diverse youth voice might not be prioritized so much, because to do authentic inclusion and engagement means that we need to have accommodations. We need to slow down, and we need to just take a breath and really allow the space to create itself. And if we're all stressed out, if we're all tight on budgets, tight on things, and we just need to, you know, deliver things quick, diverse voice and true inclusion won't happen. So I worry about that, but I am hopeful, because I think that every adult can stop and think and really think about how they want to engage young people. And when more adults are doing that, then there's going to be everyone benefits. And so, yeah, my hope, magic wand is that youth voice continues and increasingly gets prioritized. And there's a whole swath of information out there about why it's so beneficial, why it's so beneficial to your projects, how it actually saves money and how it actually in the long term. But yeah, that would be my wave my badge wand. Have enough money to not just do youth voice, but to do authentic inclusion in that youth voice.
Yeah. You think we've come a long way in the last, since you've been doing social work, since you've undertaken it, have you seen a bit of progress in this space and getting this inclusion engagement?
I think there's been more discussion. I think we all need to be following some of these, you know, you can just follow Instagram accounts that talk about what it means, lived experience. So I follow a lot of Auslan and Auslan advocates, trans advocates, a whole array of advocates and most likely young people who can tell you what it's like to them and their experiences, and you, if you just sit and listen, you just have to deeply sit and listen and do that work. And it's not hard for any of us to follow some of those Instagram accounts and just be open to listening.
Some good points there.
Yeah.
Tell us, what do you think, Louise, in closing, like what's the big thing that you want people to take away from the message today?
That listening to young people, authentically, deep listening to young people is a healing experience for everyone.
I like that. Very nice. Louise, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they reach out? How can they touch base?
So I have a new website. It's called louisegrant.com.au.
Wow. Was that a fortune to get that?
No, it was free. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
Very lucky. Maybe there's not a lot of louises.com.au's out there, but yep, louisegrant.com.au. You can see some of my work. I have a inclusive practice guide for youth advisory groups out there. I think sometimes I'm a little bit more articulate when I write than when I speak. So, and in practice than when I speak, I don't really come up.
You've done a great job. You know, it's been great. It's been really entertaining, actually. I think people will get a lot out of this.
Oh,
and,
I hope so.
And moving forward, one last question I have for you is what excites you most about what's coming up?
In the conference?
No, not in the conference, in your life and where things are heading with your work.
With my work. You know what? I've had a chance to slow down. I had a baby daughter.
Congratulations.
About 6 months ago. And I just had a chance to really slow down and see what's important in life, and it's about relationships and it's about connecting deeply with each other and slowing down. And I try to do that in my work and show the importance of that, but she really shows that to me too. So I'm looking forward to, I don't know, the future looks exciting for me.
Cool.
Yeah. And to bring another young person along in that journey, see what that's going to be like for the next generation alpha.
Is that what they're going to be called?
I think alpha. So. Yeah.
There alpha. You go.
Yeah.
Good on you. Well, Louise, I appreciate your time. It's been really insightful, a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Entertaining, but also very educational, a lot of insights. Thank you for sharing your story and those tips and everything with our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.